This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth.
That's President John F. Kennedy in May 1961, just 5 months into office, setting the goal realized with the first Apollo moon landing 50 years ago this summer. Our guest, Charles Fishman, says when Kennedy announced that goal, the U.S. couldn't have been less prepared to meet it. NASA had no rockets to launch astronauts to the moon, no computers small enough for a spacecraft, no spacesuits to wear, and very little idea how they'd pull this off. Even when the moon landing occurred in 1969, there were enough uncertainties that President Richard Nixon had a speech already written in case the astronauts died during the mission. Fishman's new book is an account of how the nation mobilized to reach the moon, emphasizing the untold stories of the 400,000 men and women who designed, built, and tested the spacecraft and equipment the astronauts used, much of the painstaking work done by hand. Charles Fishman is a longtime journalist who started reporting on the space program for The Washington Post and has written about space for The Atlantic and Smithsonian. He's also the author of the books The Walmart Effect and The Big Thirst. His new book is One Giant Leap, The Impossible Mission That Flew Us to the Moon. Charles Fishman, welcome back to Fresh Air. One of the things we learned very early in your book, which surprised me, is that the astronauts discovered the moon has a smell. What is it?
Well, the smell turns out to be the smell of fireplace ashes, or as Buzz Aldrin put it, the smell of the air after a fireworks show. This was one of the small but sort of delightful surprises about flying to the moon. NASA and the scientists supporting NASA and the astronauts were all aware of and concerned about moon dust. Moon dust had been in a vacuum for millions, if not billions of years. And there was a concern that when you brought it back into the lunar module cabin, when you brought it back into the spaceship, you know, all over your spacesuit and sealed the cabin and then pressurized it with oxygen, with an atmosphere, it might react, it might smolder or even catch fire or explode. And Armstrong and Aldrin actually had been instructed to do a little experiment. They had a little bag of lunar dirt and they put it on the engine cover of the ascent engine, which was in the middle of the lunar module cabin. And then they slowly pressurized the cabin to make sure it wouldn't catch fire, and it didn't. But then they unsnapped their helmets, and the lunar module cabin, which, to be fair, was very small, the size of a small closet or a small pantry, had been filled with the smell of this lunar dirt. It smelled like fireplace ashes, or like, as Aldrin said, the air after a fireworks show. And that was a complete surprise.
In that first mission to the moon, a lot of people were surprised by things, or at least anxious about them. And one of the little details you describe is the two astronauts were outside on the lunar surface and bouncing around and doing things. There were a few folks looking at them pretty nervously, and they'd had to do with the spacesuits. What were their concerns?
This was a moment that I actually found captivating, and it really changed my perspective on the work of the people back on Earth who sort of had to do everything that was necessary to get the astronauts to the moon. There's video of a man named Sonny Rheem who was in charge of creating the spacesuits. The spacesuits were the work of Playtex, the Cross Your Heart Bra people, which in and of itself is sort of a kind of remarkable moment in the life of NASA that they turned to Playtex to build spacesuits. And there's video of Sonny Rheem and a couple of his colleagues talking about how nervous they were because Buzz Aldrin, who had the slightly bigger personality of the two first lunar explorers, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, he was a little more antic, and Buzz Aldrin's still with us, still fairly antic. And they'd been on the surface of the moon about half an hour. And all of a sudden, Buzz Aldrin decided to see what the limits of his ability to gallivant around on the moon were, and perhaps what the limits of his spacesuit was. He started racing from one side of the landing site to the other, bunny hopping, doing sort of NFL running back cuts this way and that way. And Sonny Rheem, who was in charge of spacesuits, was in mission control in Houston with a group of spacesuit people in case something went wrong. And he describes just being petrified, just being so nervous that Buzz Aldrin was going to do something that was going to cause the spacesuits to fail. And there's the TV camera, and there's 600 million people around the world watching, and Buzz Aldrin is going to crack open his spacesuit somehow and die. And what that did for me was it just reminded me that every one of these missions was sort of pioneering. And NASA was pushing the limits every single time until you sort of get to the later missions. But I was so struck by their nervousness about their own work.
So this all happened in July of 1969. And what's fascinating about the book is it really takes us the 10 years or so before it that led to the mission. And when President Kennedy decided to challenge the nation to get to the moon in 1961, there was a certain historical context, which was we were way behind the Soviets in the race for space. And there's a wonderful little anecdote, which I had kind of forgotten about, which is the first Soviet manned flight, the astronaut Yuri Gagarin had a short flight, and his descent in particular was really interesting. Just describe that episode for us.
Yuri Gagarin took one lap around the Earth, one orbit, and the Russians had launched him without knowing how to slow down the spacecraft. And so Yuri Gagarin was ejected from his space capsule at about 40,000 feet. He and his seat and his spacesuit were ejected. The capsule came down in one place, the seat came down in another place, and Yuri Gagarin is the only space traveler to ever parachute down from his journey into space. He had parachutes. He landed in a potato field. The Soviets kept that secret for many years. The New York Times actually found someone within a few days who speculated that Gagarin's spacecraft hadn't landed with the astronaut in it. The Russians were worried that the international spaceflight body wouldn't certify it as a spaceflight if he hadn't come down with his spacecraft. That's why they kept it a secret. But it was an extraordinary end to the first ever space mission of a human being.
So the drive to reach the moon before the end of the decade was rooted in the Cold War competition with the Soviet Union. At the end of the 1950s, where did the U.S. stand in comparison to the Soviets and the reach for space?
The Soviets beat the Americans to every significant early space milestone. The Soviets launched, of course, the first space mission of any kind, Sputnik. It was just a beeping satellite. A month later, they launched a spaceship that weighed half a ton and carried the dog Laika. So they launched the first creature into space. Laika, unfortunately, never came back. Laika died in space. The Soviets launched the first creatures to space that they then recovered, who re-entered the atmosphere and were recovered safe and sound, two dogs, Strelka and Belka. The Soviets went to the moon with a robotic craft before the United States. They photographed the far side of the moon in an extraordinary sort of technical achievement, and they had the film from those photographs developed onboard the spacecraft, digitized, and sent back to Russia, all before the end of the 1950s. And then famously, of course, they launched the first person into space. That was April 12th, 1961. So John Kennedy had been president just 3 months. And at that point, both Kennedy and Congress were really frustrated at coming in second.
We should note that the American program was noted by spectacular, really spectacular failures. I mean, rockets blowing up on the launching pad.
Right. There's this very famous moment. The Russians launch Sputnik 1. 30 days later, they launch Sputnik 2, which is 1,100 pounds with a living creature in it and a TV camera. A month after that, the U.S. Vanguard program is set to launch in early December a single satellite that weighs 6 pounds. It weighed less than half what the dog Laika weighed. And that Vanguard launch got exactly 3 feet off the launch pad before it crashed back onto the launch pad at Cape Canaveral and exploded in gales of flame and smoke. And that was a worldwide mortification. The New York Times literally ran an entire page of mocking comments from the Polish army and the editorial pages of Paris, France. It was called Kaputnik and Flopnik. And it's a little hard to appreciate now, but it wasn't just an embarrassment. The Cold War was a life and death struggle. You know, the war in Korea, the Berlin Wall, the Cuban Missile Crisis, ultimately Vietnam. And so the fact that the Soviets were performing so publicly and so well in space made it look like they had drawn equal with the U.S. in sort of technical, scientific, engineering proficiency.
So when Kennedy decided in the spring of 1961 that it would be a national goal to reach the moon, how much did our scientists know about getting there?
It was literally impossible when he asked us to do it. We didn't have a spaceship that could fly to the moon. We didn't have a rocket that could launch to the moon. We didn't have a computer small enough or powerful enough to do the navigation necessary to get people to the moon. We didn't have space food. There was an argument at that moment about whether human beings would even be able to think in zero gravity. We could not have been less prepared to do this. And inside NASA, and Kennedy was told this, they thought there was only a 50-50 chance of making it safely to the moon and back by Kennedy's deadline of the end of the 60s.
So a lot of your book is looking at the people that made this happen. You know, not the astronauts, but the, you know, those who had to design and build and test all of these various systems that made the launch possible. What was the scale of this effort? How many people, how many companies, how much money?
Apollo was the biggest non-military effort in the history of human civilization. 410,000 people worked on Apollo, 20,000 companies. It's 10 times the effort to build the Panama Canal, 3 times the size of the Manhattan Project. In fact, in several years of Apollo, there were more people working on 11 space missions. There were 11 Apollo missions in the end, more people working on those than fighting in Vietnam. It was an enormous undertaking.
So one of the things that needed to be resolved was how to get some computing power on the spacecraft, which would provide guidance for the spaceships as they traveled to the moon, as they orbited around the moon, as they landed on the moon and returned. What was the state of the computer industry then?
The computer industry was just at its very beginnings. There's a wonderful moment from one of the people in charge of designing computers for the spaceships at MIT. MIT got the contract to design the computers and then program them and supervise their construction and assembly. And he said, it's hard to appreciate now, but in 1961, 1962, 1963, computers had the opposite reputation of the reputation they have now. Most computers couldn't go more than a few hours without breaking down. Even on John Glenn's famous orbital flight, the first U.S. orbital flight, the computers in mission control stopped working for 3 minutes of 4 hours. Well, that's only 3 minutes of 4 hours, but that was the most important computer in the world during that 4 hours, and they couldn't keep it going during the entire orbital mission of John Glenn. So they needed computers that were small, lightweight, fast, and absolutely reliable. And the computers that were available then, even the compact computers, were the size of 2 or 3 refrigerators next to each other. And so this was a huge technology development undertaking of Apollo. We often hear almost dismissively that the race to the moon didn't involve any kind of fundamental breakthroughs the way the Manhattan Project did. But taking a computer the size of three refrigerators lined up next to each other and making it literally the size of a small briefcase and having the small one be much more powerful and much more capable than the big one, that was a fundamental breakthrough, and MIT did it.
There's something you describe in the book. I don't exactly understand this, but that the software code was woven into the memory of the Apollo guidance computer, and this required people who turned out to be women who essentially almost did the work of seamstresses with this very, very thin wire. Can you explain what this process was?
Well, you've got it almost exactly right. It's just hard to get your brain around. There was no computer memory of the sort we think of now. And so the computer memory for the Apollo computer, what happened was, and this happened not just in the computer, but in a couple of other arenas, the ability to conceive the technology that was needed ran a little bit ahead of the ability to manufacture it. And the computers were a perfect example. There was no computer memory of the sort that we think of now on computer chips. The memory was literally woven in ones and zeros onto modules. And the only way to get the wires exactly right was to have people using needles and, instead of thread, wire, weave the computer program one and zero at a time. The Apollo computers had a total of 73K of memory. If you get an email with the morning headlines from your local newspaper, it takes up more space than 73K, right? And it took these women, and they turned out to be women. They hired seamstresses who were every wire had to be right, because if you got a one or a zero wrong, the computer program didn't work. They hired women, and it took 8 weeks to manufacture the memory for a single Apollo flight computer. And that 8 weeks of manufacturing was literally sitting at sophisticated looms, weaving wires one wire at a time.
There's a lovely little detail where Raytheon had a strike, some management people tried to substitute, right? Some guys, with not particularly positive results.
It turned out, right. Raytheon had a strike in the middle of the race to the moon, and all the factory workers walked out, and the supervisors tried to do the work that the women had been doing. And as one of the supervisors said, everything we made was trash. It all went in the garbage when the strike was over.
So what's the state of American space exploration today?
It's a little bit of a both exciting moment and a sad moment. The United States today has no way of putting its own astronauts into space. We rely on the Russian Soyuz spacecraft, which was first conceived and built in 1965. So the nation that beat the Russians to the moon now has no way of getting its own astronauts into space. We have less capacity as a spacefaring nation than we did in 1965, and we are literally depending on 30-year-old technology from the nation that we raced to the moon successfully. So NASA's space program, the manned part, is sort of in a ditch at the moment. The exciting part of the space program, one of the exciting elements, is the unmanned robotic probes. NASA does a really spectacular job with that. You don't need to watch those missions over the shoulder of the JPL folks every day. But when those pictures come back from Mars, from the orbiting space telescopes, that really opens a window on the universe. And that work is spectacular. And, you know, we're having a real blossoming of what may turn out to be the dawn of the space age we imagined was coming, the Jetsons-style space age we always imagined was coming in the 1960s. Elon Musk and SpaceX, Jeff Bezos and Blue Origin, those guys are really driving the development of space infrastructure. how do we get the cost of going to space down and the reliability up? We need rockets we can reuse over and over again. We don't fly from LAX to LaGuardia and then throw the jet away every day. That seems insane. And then tomorrow we get a new one, get to LaGuardia and throw the plane away. But that's how we've run space travel until now. And Bezos and Musk are really driving a new era in which the cost of going to space will come down literally by 90 or 99% because we'll use rockets the way we use airplanes. That's not going to happen by 2025, but it is quite possible that 15 or 20 years from now, you'll be able to go to space as part of your routine work the way people go to an offshore oil rig or go spend 6 months in orbit doing scientific research the way somebody might go spend 6 months in Delhi or 6 months in Beijing on a work assignment. I think we're at the dawn of an era in which space travel for important purposes will become a lot more routine.
Well, Charles Fishman, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Dave.
Charles Fishman's book is One Giant Leap, The Impossible Mission That Flew Us to the Moon. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Bruce Springsteen has been going through a period of trying new things, including an extended run on Broadway and a one-man autobiographical show. Now he has a new solo album called Western Stars, which Springsteen says draws inspiration from the Southern California pop records of the late 1960s and early 70s. Here's Ken's review of Western Stars.
Had enough of heartbreaking pain. Had a little sweet spot for the rain, for the rain and skies of gray. Hello, sunshine, won't you stay?
Had enough of heartbreak and pain, sings Bruce Springsteen in the opening words of that song called Hello, Sunshine. What's this? A Bruce Springsteen casting aside heartbreak and pain? I would not have thought such a boss could exist. Nevertheless, there remains something guarded in his tone as he greets the bright sun. Even with a West Coast tan, Springsteen remains restless, searching.
I got so down and out in Frisco, tired of the pills and the rain. I picked up headed for the sunshine. I left a good thing behind. Seemed all of our love was in vain. Now my baby's coming in on the Tucson train.
In his 2016 autobiography and subsequent Broadway show, one of the things Springsteen performed was a demystification of his image, a critique of the authenticity myth that surrounds him, and which he sometimes feels as a trap. That process continues on this album, which is an intentional, if only temporary, move away from the earthy naturalism of the E Street Band. In its place are string sections, oboes, French horns. For the source of this, Springsteen has directed our attention to Jimmy Webb's hits with Glenn Campbell, like Wichita Lineman and Galveston. Springsteen's open-hearted response to them is new songs with similarly geographical titles like Tucson Train and Somewhere North of Nashville. Half a century ago, the film studios used to hire Frankie Lane or Johnny Horton to sing the sort of Western movie ballads Springsteen conjures up in a new song like Sundown.
I'm 2,500 miles from where.
be honest, I've always found Jimmy Webb's songwriting and arrangements overwrought and mawkish. But in using them as sparks for his own creativity here, Springsteen is aided immeasurably by the roughness of his voice, which cuts the sap, and the strict denial of sentimentality in his own lyrics. The result is California-style pop with a boss twist, sunset melancholy worthy of the Mamas and the Papas and the Beau Brummels.
I woke up this morning with stones in my mouth. Said those were only the lies you've told me. Those are only the lies you've told me. I pulled my collar to the wind and spit them on the ground. You said those are only the lies you've told me. Those are only the lies you've told me. Sat on the edge of our bed in the sun. I felt them gather on my tongue. I woke up.
That's called Stones, with that stark, beautiful refrain. The title song, Western Stars, plays on two of its meanings: the starry frontier sky, and the cinematic celebrities that used to roam the Old West. Monty Hellman's 1966 Western Ride in the Whirlwind gets name-checked in Western Stars, as does John Wayne. You just know that the wide-open spaces of Springsteen's expansive arrangements are meant to put you in mind of John Ford Westerns like The Searchers and She Wore a Yellow Ribbon.
Once I was shot by John Wayne. It was towards the end. That one scene's brought me a thousand drinks. Set me up and I'll tell it for you, friend. Here's to the cowboys, riders in the whirlwind. Tonight the western stars are shining bright again. And the western stars are shining bright again. Till at the riders on sunset are smothered in the Santa Ana wind. And the western stars are shining bright again. Come on. I woke up this morning, just glad my boots were on.
Ultimately, no matter how different the music around him may sound, Springsteen has made a Springsteen album, populated by slightly different characters, movie extras and stuntmen, exhausted couples that check into a place called the Moonlight Motel. When the sun comes up, they'll get in their car, and Bruce will be in the back seat, serenading them as they drive onto Los Angeles in hopes of changing their bad luck for good.
Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed Bruce Springsteen's new album called Western Stars. Coming up, we hear from Damian Lewis. He's a classically trained British actor who's played a lot of Americans, including a ruthless hedge fund manager on Showtime's Billions and a Marine sergeant who converts to Islam in Homeland. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. Our next guest, actor Damian Lewis, has become something of a staple on hit American TV series. He played a World War II hero in the HBO series Band of Brothers. In the Showtime series Homeland, he was an American Marine sergeant who returns from captivity in Syria with ties to terrorists, a role that earned him a Golden Globe and a Primetime Emmy Award. And in the Showtime series Billions, he plays the ruthless hedge fund manager Bobby Axelrod, who's pursued by an ethically challenged federal prosecutor played by Paul Giamatti. Despite his convincing portrayal of Americans of blue-collar origin, Lewis is a classically trained British actor who attended Eton, the historic boarding school known for educating British aristocrats and royals. Well, Damian Lewis, welcome to Fresh Air.
Good morning. Hi.
Let's talk about Billions, the series on Showtime which you're starring in. And I thought we'd begin by hearing a clip. This is from season 4. You play Bobby Axelrod, this tough-as-nails hedge fund manager. You came up from the streets and made it in the financial world. And you're on an airport tarmac where a Russian oligarch who's played by John Malkovich, who's been an adversary of yours, is getting on his private jet because he's been ordered out of the country by the state attorney general. And as it happens, you, Bobby Axelrod, actually engineered this. And you've come to the tarmac to have a final word with him as he's dealing with this defeat and humiliation. And as it opens, we hear you tell your adversary that you have a parting gift for him.
The few billion that you have at Tater Mason Capital will be unfrozen and released back to you once you land back home.
That's something, but it is actually my money you're giving back to me. I'm not sure how much gratitude that buys.
Do you want it or not?
Yeah, sure. Will I get it?
You will. The moment you land, as I said.
Good.
Gregor, listen. Here's the thing. After the cash hits your account, you may start feeling that you didn't get your satisfaction, that you have some further score you want to settle with me. You're going to want to tamp down that feeling. Sure, it's true. I didn't have you do my killing for me. But don't let that trick you into thinking that I don't have the will or the ability to do it under different circumstances. Like when I'm threatened. You send someone after me here, they're going to find that I'm a very insulated, protected, and powerful man in these parts, and there is nothing that I won't do to defend what's mine.
That is our guest Damian Lewis on the series Billions, speaking there with John Malkovich. What appealed to you about this role?
When I came over to talk to the guys about whether we'd move forward with this, and by the guys, I mean Brian Koppelman and David Levine, I wanted to know what their worldview was, because it seemed clear to me that that is the direction the show would go in. And what we have at the outset is we have a mythic context of a sheriff and a cowboy, a sheriff and a gunslinger. The sheriff is played in this case by Paul Giamatti, the U.S. attorney, and I play the gunslinger, who is a hedge fund manager here in New York. And what the guys wanted to explore was the way in which the politically and financially powerful here live and operate, and the different moral code by which they seem to live by. And what became clear was that this was going to be a world, and what has become clear over the last 3 or 4 years is a world that absolute power corrupts absolutely. And even the good guys do bad things. The bad guys will occasionally do good things. Loyalty is paramount. So it's a world of ego and power. And Bobby Axelrod was set up as a guy who was in some ways the embodiment of the American dream, a blue-collar alley cat, a scrapper with a mid-ranging university education. They make a big deal of the fact that he was at Hofstra. He is not an Ivy League guy, and he has become a billionaire.
I read that Andrew Ross Sorkin, the New York Times financial writer, who was also, a co-producer, co-creator, introduced you to some hedge fund executives. What did you want to learn from them, from those meetings?
It would be too simplistic just to lump them all into one group. They were all very different characters, some with an explicit vanity in, you know, the cost of their haircut, to the suits they wore, to the winter jackets they had, and the offices with priceless works of art on the walls. But I found with every single one of them, probably the one thing I could say is they were all incredibly focused listeners and were all keen to impress on me that this was not a Wall Street environment anymore. This was not a Gordon Gekko environment anymore. It wasn't dog eat dog. It was much more a risk intolerant, analytical, scientific world where risk was removed from the equation before a bet is made, before an investment is made.
It's not that they're ripping people's throats out. It's that they're smarter and more analytical than everybody else.
Before they rip someone's throat out.
Right. Any mannerisms or personality traits that you kind of integrated into Bobby Axelrod's character?
Brian and David had written something of a rock star, a guy with swagger and confidence. I wanted to give him a sense of the street, so nothing too refined. He is a guy who's committed to wearing, you know, $1,000 sneakers and jeans and cashmere hoodies. That's his thing, rather than an expensive Italian suit. I wanted to find a prowl in him, something predatory in him. And ever since I was trained as an actor, I've always enjoyed using animals, finding that sort of anthropomorphic quality between human beings and animals. And I sort of found a cheetah quality in him that I have used, you know, from the get-go.
Right. When you were filming the first season, it was probably during the 2016 election. And I'm wondering how, you know, Trump and the Trump administration have influenced your thinking or the plot lines as this has developed.
Well, it was fascinating having a president in the White House who tore up the political and diplomatic rule book and said, no, what's king here is the transaction, is the deal, and I will go and I will make deals for America. Bobby Axelrod is entirely a transactional human being. This is not unlike the current president. So it's been a happy thing for us that he's been there, weirdly, because it does make our show even more, I think, contemporary, more current, even more explicitly a commentary on contemporary America. That might seem pessimistic because the show has quite a bleak worldview, but these things go on. So
you didn't grow up in a background like Bobby Axelrod, but you didn't come from humble origins. Tell us a little bit about your family and your schooling.
No, I'm a privately educated Brit. I couldn't have come from a further away world than Bobby, I guess. I grew up on Abbey Road, actually. Any fan of the Beatles will know where that is, in North London. I went to boarding schools from an early age, from the age of 8, and came out of school at the age of 18 and knew by that stage I wanted to be an actor and went about trying to do that.
Did it ever occur to you that you had a particularly interesting face?
there was a very brutal exercise that we were asked to do at drama school. We spent one semester, one of our classes was on makeup, and they give you a piece of paper with a blank oval shape on it, which is your head, and you had to stare at yourself in the mirror for an entire semester and draw on this blank oval your face with all its imperfections. So you knew every imperfection on your face, and there is nothing that is straight or symmetrical or matching on my face. I can tell you that. So it's kind of a depressing exercise when you do it, but it's also incredibly useful when you're making yourself up in the theater. But no, I never thought I had an interesting face. In fact, the opposite. I probably worried that I didn't have the right kind of face.
The point of the exercise was to be aware of what you could do with your face on stage?
Really, it was a makeup exercise. If you've got a bent nose and you want it straightened, you know how to shade and highlight in order to do that. If you want to exaggerate an imperfection, like one of your ears is higher than the other or one eye is smaller than the other, all of which is true of me. If your mouth doesn't sit directly under your nose, which is also true of me, you know, and you might be playing a character. You might think that's useful. So let's exaggerate that. Let's use makeup to stick your mouth even further out of the way from under your nose, or exaggerate your broken nose, which I have from playing cricket when I was 11 years old. That kind of stuff.
I want to talk about Homeland, which was a big deal, the Showtime series that you were in for 3 seasons. Your character is this Marine who served overseas, was captured and held and tortured for years. And it's a wild plot. You end up becoming involved with American politics and intelligence. We learn that your character actually is a Muslim, is involved with terrorist groups. There's a lot going on with this character. How did you prepare for this role?
I sort of looked at 3 separate strands of it. What it was like to be a Marine. And I had some experience of soldiering through Band of Brothers, but I researched being a Marine. I spoke to a couple of Marines. I also looked at PTSD, and I went to a unit, a facility in England, and spoke to them about the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder. And I read the Quran, and I went to the Central London Mosque, which is not far from where I live, and they welcomed me in there. And in fact, when I was in North Carolina, I also spent some time in the mosque. There's a very small mosque there, run by a nice cleric there, a mullah there, who I think was from Lebanon, actually. And there are about 10,000 Muslims in Charlotte, North Carolina. And so I spent a bit of time there just absorbing the culture and read the Quran. And that was it, really. That's how I prepared for it.
Yeah, it's interesting because the series, you know, I think was at times drew criticism for demonizing Muslims and at other times being too kind to Al-Qaeda. Did any of that criticism, I don't know, affect what you did on the set? Or did it, I guess it, a lot of it came long after you'd finished the episodes, right?
Well, certainly in the first 3 seasons when I was there, I was approached often by Muslims in the street who would thank me for a sensitive portrayal of being Muslim, of worshipping in the faith. And I think that's because whenever Nicholas Brody, although there were clear associations between having adopted the Muslim faith and wanting to blow people up, whenever he was alone and praying, I think people felt there was a sensitivity and an authenticity to that, and they thanked me for that.
One more thing about Homeland. I read that President Obama, I think he was doing a state dinner for David Cameron, and he invited you and your wife, actress Helen McCrory, to attend, and you sat at the table with him. Is this true?
This is true. We were fully expecting to walk into the this marquee for 400 people on the South Lawn at the White House and to be sat next to the restrooms. And we were shown to this table, which seemed to be very close to the stage, where a band was going to perform later. And then the president walked in with our prime minister and walked straight to our table and sat opposite us. And we were amazed. And I had Warren Buffett on my left. I had an Afghanistan vet on my right who had won the Medal of Honor for an act of extreme bravery that I would wish we had long enough for me to go into and talk to you about now. But he had a bionic arm.
And you gave the president a gift, as I've read, right?
Well, yes. this was one of my more irreverent moments. I'm slightly blushing now to remember that I did it. But the Teamsters for the Democrats came to visit us down in Charlotte and said, we've got a box set for the president. Would you like to sign a message to him? And I'm a huge fan, always was, of President Obama, and was, of course, very aware of all the accusations. One of them, some of them made by our current president, about his birthright, his nationality. And so I wrote, ironically, from one Muslim to another, and your great fan, Damian Lewis, and sent this off to the White House, and then had a panic a few weeks later that I just hope he has a sense of irony and knows that this is a joke and why the joke's been made. And so, and I'd become friends with Jay, who was his who was the press officer at the White House at the time. And I sent an email and said, Jay, please tell me that my joke was understood. And he sent me an email back the next day, reassuring me, said the president thought it was very funny and says thank you. And so I felt relieved. But there was a moment when I felt my cheekiness had, had maybe crossed the line. But I got away with it.
You know, there are so many British actors that do terrific American accents. Like I think of Dominic West, who was in The Wire, who I think you were a schoolmate of, right?
Dom's a very good pal.
And I wonder, when Americans try to do British accents, do the British actors kind of laugh at them behind their backs?
I want to debunk this myth. Look, part of America's imperialism of the last century has been cultural imperialism, and we all grew up watching endless American shows. You know, I grew up watching Batman and then all those amazing TV shows from the early 80s, Chips and Dukes of Hazzard and Hunter, works for me, and all those shows. And a lot of us English actors do manage to come up with a pretty good American accent, but I've heard some English actors that don't. And I've heard some American actors do incredibly convincing English accents, too. So, you know.
Fair enough. Okay.
I suppose it sticks out. It sticks out when someone misses. But I think we probably have a slight advantage because, you know, we're not France. We've welcomed American culture. We're the bridge between Europe and America. That's our special relationship. And we've grown up with a lot of American culture.
Well, it's been fun. Damian Lewis, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Damian Lewis stars in the Showtime series Billions. It's been renewed for a fifth season. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham and Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Challoner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.